Are you sure you got your forehead out?
I didn't say that, bro.
That's what you said. Welcome and welcome back to How to Make a TV Show Without a Studio. My name is Imelda, writer, director, producer, and professional sad girl, both in emotion and social anxiety. I'm here with Michael Elonihana.
Elonihana, writer, director, producer, musician, and I'm wearing purple today. I've been trying to do a different one every time, and they've been really good.
You've been resorted to your clothes. We are two filmmakers.
I'm Michael Elonihana, writer, director, producer, musician, and I am Warhol in the flesh. I am Walt Disney. Nike.
Google.
Because I'm wearing Nike. It's all right, carry on.
We are two filmmakers passionate about stories and we are trying to figure out how to make them and how to get people to see them. What is the title of today's episode?
This is episode 8 and it is How to Cast Your Cast, The Interview. I keep doing that like I'm going to edit The Interview in my hands, but I'm probably not going to.
Yeah, please don't do that. Cause that's
The Interview.
If you haven't yet, please watch our last episodes. There is a few. They're all up on this YouTube channel. We would appreciate you guys to follow along, subscribe,
yes.
Like our vibe, do the whole nine. Links are below for the pod for the Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Links are below for the Kickstarter. And yeah, we appreciate you guys being here. Give us a disclaimer.
Me and Imelda are just talking from our experiences coming from the film industry. We do not believe in 10 steps. Although this is how to build a TV show without a studio, we don't believe in 10 steps to life. We don't believe in 5 steps to life. We don't want to Stephen Bartlett the world and be like, hey, this is how you do things. We're just here giving you some experiences and hopefully we can be like little bookmarks or little notes in your bigger essay in life. So we are human beings who will make mistakes and sometimes say things that you don't agree with. And that's okay, because you might do things that we don't agree with. That's all right.
That's good.
Yeah.
Well done, mate.
Good?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's sad that you keep mentioning Stephen Bartlett, though.
Well, do you know what?
We're not Stephen Bartlett.
It's like, well, no. Well, maybe not here. Maybe not just Stephen Bartlett. But
all
like,
of them.
All of them. Like... Because it's just like 10 steps to life is bollocks, isn't it? It's like, it's not smart to be like, here are the 10 steps to make a film because you might not, it might not work. Do you know what I mean? People say, go to the BFI.
Oh, Lord.
And, you know, apply and you'll get it. And lots of people don't. So I can't be like, that's the definite way to get film. You've got to just take it and like, you know, use it as part of your journey. Don't use it as a Bible. It's not going to work. Stephen Bartlett.
We are here with the most amazing and most wonderful human being.
A beautiful friend of ours.
Grace Safe. Woo! Grace Safe trained at RADA. Her work in theatre, like Ballet Shoes for the National Theatre, Sea Creatures for Hampstead Theatre, Athena for Yard Theatre, The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, is that right?
Yeah.
For Donmar Theatre, Mary Stuart for Almeida Theatre, When You Cure Me, A Bitter Herb, Blues for an Alabama Sky, Macbeth and Girls and Dolls at RADA. Her TV credits include Anansi Boys for Amazon and 13 Reasons Why, seasons 3 and 4 for Netflix. Her voice work includes Elden Ring. Why are you guys?
I'm so sorry. This is all my fault. Please, you're doing this. It's really nice.
Her voice work includes Elden Ring from Software, Xenoblade Chronicles 3 from Monolith Soft, Alan Wake 2, Remedy Entertainment, World of Warcraft, Battle for Azeroth by Blizzard, Wonder Blocks for Blue Zoo and CBeebies, and Halfway for Sable Labs and Audible.
Yeah.
Woo!
Written by us.
That was written by us, yes, that was one.
And Grace, you've done a lot. You've done, that's like...
It's stacked.
It makes me look really good.
Stacked on the theatre, you know.
Rats, mate.
Stacked on the theatre, an Amazon show, a Netflix show.
I know.
And my, all of the games that all the nerds like.
My throat is sore. she's got
all the nerdy games.
Oh, man.
The queen of the nerdy games.
Yeah.
That's my life.
How are you, Grace?
I'm good.
Good, man. It's really good to have you.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here. Yay.
Yeah, man.
Very excited. Very excited.
It's easier when you're doing it with a friend, and we love you so much, and you're and so it's gonna be a great.
Yeah,
great
and you're gonna put up with me for the mic, you know. I've spent 3 minutes trying to figure out how to orientate myself on the sofa. And when you watch this bag, it's just going to be like...
well, like a cut of every place. Like,
you know that interview with that guy who ends up on like a BBC interview and he's in the wrong interview?
Yeah.
It's like I'm not meant to be here for the first like intro.
That's hilarious.
Oh, my
God. okay, so how did you get into the industry?
Yes, how did I get into the industry? So I started with taking drama at school with like a lot of people, and through kind of studies and stuff, my teachers kind of encouraged me to kind of look into more programs. So I did a short summer course at the National Youth Theatre. That was like a 2-week course, and also I went to Northwall Arts Centre in Oxford, and they have a kind of residency program there where you're working with new writers and you have an ensemble and you work in literally very short time frame and you kind of put that stuff together. It was my drama teachers at Hazelwick that really intrigued me, because at the time it's just a subject, you know what I mean? Like when you're in school, I don't know where people are watching this from, but drama I feel like is kind of seen as a lesson where you can just like bunk off for like you just piss around and da-da-da. And it was maybe our teacher's approach. I had a teacher called Mr. Williams who kind of pieced in a lot of real world history into our subjects. We didn't quite follow a curriculum per se, or I don't think we followed the curriculum like other schools did. And this isn't an art school or a specific like specialist school, just a regular school. And he would teach us things like, I remember when we were doing Romeo and Juliet, he brought in these images from the Bosnian genocide, from the civil war.
Wow. Cool.
And there was a couple called Edmira and Boshko who were caught in crossfire as they were trying to escape the city together. And there's this very famous image of them lying in each other's arms. and so when we then went and revisited Romeo and Juliet, there was the understanding that you, they were on different sides of that that war. Civil war, and so it basically contextualized things. Even if something feels very, very far away from us, like Shakespeare for students who are, you know, 12, 13, it's not quite, you know, maybe it's a bit boring or it's just quite abstract. And I think the lesson that they gave me was, you know, this might seem so out of reach and really far away, but this is, the stakes are real to someone somewhere. And I kind of held that in the back of my mind, and we did that with everything, like our school productions. Like I remember we did Billy Elliot the musical, but like learning about Thatcherism and learning about the social economic situation of Northeast England in the 80s. So we weren't just you know, ever just simply doing
a performance.
Our teachers always kind of turned it into a kind of educational opportunity, maybe. And it's
that.
not in a kind of, I don't know if dogmatic's the right word, but not in a beating us over the head kind of way, or you know, purposely with a kind of agenda. It was more just making us curious about the world and what that, how that relates to the piece that we're doing. But anyway, by the time I got to sixth form, I wasn't really sure if I was gonna go into drama, and my drama teacher, Gemma Grubb, told me to go to a drama school, which I'd never heard of. I don't know why. You know, growing up, I loved TV. I watched so much TV and so much film. Like I was like literally that kid in front of the TV from 5 a.m. to 11 p.m.
Literally like us.
I mean, my mum was working full time. So I was just me and that TV. But I just didn't think actors came from anywhere. I thought they just were beings doing on the TV. You know what I mean? When you're a kid, you don't really think someone trains and goes and does that, and it's a job, and they say cut, and they
they have a life.
Like, that's them.
Yeah. Hello everyone, sorry to stop the video. We are here to talk to you about my favorite breakfast cereal, Huel. No, I'm joking. The Kickstarter is out. The Kickstarter is out right now. Please share that. Please share that with your friends, share that with your family. Go down to Kickstarter right now. All the links are in the bio and everything there.
Description box.
In the description box. Please go and do that. Follow us on our TikToks, on our socials and all that. And please...
At Hort Honor.
And please help us. Help us get to our goal. You know, we're really trying to make this full TV show and you can help us. You can help us make 6 absolute episodes, which will be phenomenal. So yeah, please subscribe. Please subscribe and please...
Donate.
Go to the Kickstarter and donate. Give it. Let's do please donate. And
please donate.
Let's have that one in. Yeah, that's cool.
Amazing.
So I went to drama school auditions and I got through and I got offered a place. And I'd say even at that point, I wasn't sure I wanted to do this in the industry. I asked my mum if I should go to uni or drama school. And my mum said, you should do drama school while you're young, while your body is young. Yeah. Be tired.
Shout out, mum.
Yeah,
shout out,
mom. And you can go to uni at any time in life because my mum's gone back as a mature student. So at first I thought I was going to drama school for maybe a more practical experience. And a lot of my stuff in school was ensemble work. We did like Greek myths or Shakespeare and stuff. And a lot of it was just ensemble, no text. So I also wanted to challenge myself to know what it's like to be an individual performer, not part of an ensemble. And it was literally, I'd say, probably at the end of my third year that I thought, okay, I think I will actually go into the industry, which might sound like a bit insane, but I just wasn't, I think there's the practical part of my mind, like no one in my family is in the arts or is from that background. And I wasn't really sure like how likely it is for you to actually do something like acting full time. So in a lot of ways I've been lucky. I think also I was lucky in that the stakes were quite low for me. For a lot of people who'd been trying to go into drama school for multiple years, I didn't even know this existed. And honestly, I thought my audition was an open day.
Right.
I thought, because I only knew about uni, so I was like, oh, it's like an open day, but you have to like do a speech. So
right,
you know, my stakes were like stupidly low. Like I made some humongous errors, but I was like, you know, if you just don't know, a house is on fire,
I just had no idea.
Like,
that's so cool, though.
But yeah, in my third year, I was like, yeah, this is what I want to do. I saw some really powerful performances at RADA during that time, like Tamara Lawrence and Ron Kay, Decla Wejo, and they really just transformed like what was possible for me. But transformed what was possible for me. And they were students at the time, or Ronke was a fresh graduate at the time, and just changed my whole world. And I thought, well, whatever it is that they are doing, that's what I want to go and train and be able to do, and want to keep striving for that level of performance. Really sick.
That's really dope.
I love that.
Yeah, man.
That's good.
I know, it's like heartwarming, isn't it?
It is, isn't it?
For real, I think like one of the things that I really admire about you, knowing you as a friend, is I think that like how normal you are. So like particularly when we're in the industry, you have a lot of like, sometimes you have friends that you've made like when you're on a job, and like, okay, we met when we were on a job, and then you talk a lot about acting stuff.
We talk a lot about
like film stuff, and that's great. You can have those relationships. But I think what we found with you is like we've had you in our house and we've just been chilling and just been like talking about like normal work. And you're not one of those people that necessarily like screams about the work that you do. You're always like, oh, sick.
It's nice to know you as a human being.
Yeah, and to know that like acting is something that you actually just like live.
It's not, I
don't really get like the, you know, hey man, I'm trying to make $1 million.
Oh, right, like the hustle.
Yeah. And it's like, but it's also like, you're like, she's crazy with it.
Yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean? I would say like Grace is one of my favorite actresses. Like, she's like crazy with it. But like, so, yeah, like, no, legit. Like,
She's crazy.
But you know what I mean? You know, like when you see Michael Jackson dance and you're like, fuck. I feel the right. same when I see you act.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think the way that you are as a human being, really, and hearing that background shows that, like, you know, acting is just like the thing that you like love to do. Mm. And it's also nice to hear it from that perspective, because from this whole episode, from this series, while we've been doing this podcast, we've been doing a lot of talk about like your why. It's like, what is your why?
Yeah.
So yeah, I wanted to say that before we wanted to just give you flowers before we go in. Because it's nice to be like
flowers handed.
Flowers. yeah, they're in. yeah, they're in the pot over there.
Thank you. No, I really appreciate that. That's very, very kind.
No worries, man.
So obviously, we've been talking this week about like casting, and I just wanted to kind of ask, like, what is a? And you've been in loads of things, as we've seen, both screen, theatre, and audio stuff, and not a lot of actors, I believe, are as multifaceted in regards to acting as that.
Yeah.
What is a typical casting experience like for an actor? And maybe what do you also expect out of the casting experience?
So I don't know if this is really reflective of how it goes for like other actors or for the majority of actors. Primarily, I'm getting my material through my agent. They send me through work. Sometimes it's been a bit more. Sometimes you're just taping, sending off tapes. That's kind of gone up, I think, since the pandemic. And there's kind of pros and cons for that. There's a lot of actors who cannot afford the travel expenses. Yeah. So it's much better to tape from home. There are other people who feel like they are stronger in person. Mm. So it's kind of frustrating to be locked behind like tapes. But yeah, through tapes. Sometimes I go for an in-person meeting, but like I said, I just don't think that's happening as much anymore. And for games, I do a lot of tapes. There's not so, there are maybe slightly more auditions in person, actually in the booth, but primarily I'm getting that material through my agent. I know that there's Spotlight directory for open castings, but yeah, that's my main experience
of
the casting process. And sometimes there's several stages for callbacks. There was one piece that, that, I don't know if I can. Okay, no, but there's a few stages to it, a few stages to it, and the last, I think we had 4 callbacks, and the last one was on a Zoom audition with the actor because they were based in
a different country.
I don't know why it's that, because it's not like I signed an NDA. No, I don't think I signed an NDA. It's out. But they were in Tokyo, so they were very, very far ahead of us and behind us, and. That was a lot. There was a lot of process. It's a lot of hours of your, time to prepare, I think, thoroughly for that kind of stuff. Mm. Which, it's an interesting thing. The cast, like that kind of process, the amount of work that you're doing is almost the majority of it is when you're not being paid to work. Workload, there was a tape that I sent in for a game and I maybe spent 8 to 10 hours on it, which I know some voice crazy. Actors are going, you dummy, why are you spending that long? They just took the time that it took, so most of the work that you're doing isn't actually when you're on set and being paid to do it. I think that's an interesting side to this thing.
What do you prefer? Do you prefer like in-person stuff or do you prefer like I'll do the tape or I'll do the recording and then I'll send it off and then I can just leave?
Oh, that's a tough one because I feel like I prefer tapes.
Okay.
My agent's kind of a deep person. I just feel like the thing I don't mind either process, but I feel what's hard about in-person auditions is that you'll have this kind of very, how did you get here? Was that centralized? So hot, isn't it? And you're like, okay, and your kid's dead.
Yeah. Right,
and
right.
Too much. I think I play into that kind of jovial, kind of cordial nicety.
Yeah.
I find it very hard to switch that off.
Right.
And then go into, because it's not like they go away for like 10 minutes and then you're literally going straight into it. And I just find it really hard to make that switch. It's that kind of like, that British niceties, kind of like,
yeah.
And then you're trying to do something. I find that you can just eliminate that when you're doing types at home, and you can obviously go it as many times as you need to, but maybe that's maybe one of the problems about tapes, that you do it so many times, it becomes static, right. And you can't respond to feedback and change. Because I think the biggest part of an audition is that they're seeing how much you can change it, right?
Mm. Yeah.
Not just how well your initial take on the material is. They're trying to see how well do you respond to a note, or how many ways can you interpret this?
Yeah.
Mm. I think there's merit in both, but for that part, maybe I prefer...
Yeah,
tapes.
That's really interesting, because I think
control freak, but I don't know.
I think no, because I feel like I would like general meetings as a writer.
Mm. Yeah, 100%.
I'm always like, get this in person, because I can't do the Zoom thing. And obviously now that we're trying to build this TV show, everything's been via Zoom.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
We'll get you on a Zoom, Google Meet actually. Yeah. We'll get you. on a G Meet.
Yeah, because Zoom is jarring.
Yeah, I mean,
Zoom is so dead.
You know, unfortunately, like I Zoom the least.
Yeah.
You know, it's a G Meet or a Microsoft Teams, and I hate Teams, but I do Microsoft Teams for a part-time work, but whatever. Teams is so stressful. So everything's via, like, you know, a Google Meet.
Yeah, but then our auditions were in person. Our callbacks were in person,
but then it was an initial tape. And I think for ease, it's just made things so much easier and instant.
For real.
But I think when it comes to, like, general meetings and stuff, maybe when I'm putting my best foot forward, I think it's really funny that you were talking about, like, the politeness that you, the sort of fakeness that turn on. Whereas I feel like... For me, I'm anxious actually more about the things that are out of my control, like the technical difficulties that could possibly happen.
Yeah.
Or whether I'm in a meeting before the pastor. Yeah. And I'm like, oh God, how am I coming here? Am I breaking up? Is it slow? Yeah. Is there all of that? And they're like, tell me about your work, and I'm like, But then when it's in person, I feel like I can pretend for an hour.
I can be like,
but then I think I'm not auditioning for anything. Yeah. I'm just sort of like putting my best pretend. Yeah. I'm doing the politeness the whole way through. Yeah. And I know I'm going in, I'm going to be polite for an hour, and then I'm going to crash afterwards.
But
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think that's really interesting, because you're both kind of talking about how you can control the environment the best, in the best way possible. So you're going, there's less factors to think about if I'm just in front of you.
Yeah.
And there's more factors to think about if I'm in front
of you.
Yeah,
it's not like you just enjoy one.
But no, it's so interesting.
Which one's just stressful for me.
Yeah. It's so interesting, but that's it. Cause that kind of makes me want to ask, like, when you're going for an audition, how much do you think about, like, the director or, like, the story as a whole? Are you just like, I'm here for the character and that's it? Or do you think about the bigger world of the film or television or theatre show
regardless
or audio story?
Yeah.
You know, you've done them all, you know, so.
Is that a kind of question of, like, what do I take into priority, or is it more like a preparation?
Just what you take into priority. Like, do you think, if an audition came to your step today, would you just be thinking about the text, or do you start thinking about, like, the director or what they want?
Right. It's hard. It depends on how much time you get.
Yeah.
Because you can get an audition from 2 weeks ahead up to, you know, like the night before. Yeah. I've seen people a couple of hours before.
Crazy.
So if I had all the time in the world, I'm trying to gather as much information about it from every angle as possible. So I'm looking at director, I'm looking at the work that they do, trying to kind of pick up what their kind of taste or style is from that. I'm looking at the material. If I'm getting sent sides, I try and see if, you know, if it's adapted from anything. I try and find the original material and try and read outside of that. I've had an audition for something where my character's actually invented for the show. So I went and read the book and I was like,
and where are they?
In the end. No, but I think it's like if it was like up on a wall, you know, you've got lots of spiraling out parts. Just
okay,
there's so many things that could give you ideas, I think, for the audition. That's why I do it anyway. In terms of material, I'm trying to prepare the material as much as possible. But I think the character stuff helps in case you are asked to kind of go off maybe the tracks of the text itself. Like, yeah. I haven't done this in a very long time, but I know some directors do a lot of improvisation.
Right.
Yeah. For me to say that word, I actually don't like that word. It's so bad because that is a necessary blood lifeline of the performance.
Yeah.
You can spontaneously.
Two dogs just died, go.
I actually cannot.
You're in a restaurant and you ordered fried chicken, but it gave you a vegan burger.
I could burst into tears actually in an improv class. I have at drama schools. It was like my least favorite subject.
Oh, right.
I know people say you're not meant to. You don't have to be funny.
Yeah.
Everyone's expecting you to do something.
Yeah.
Well, improv is so connected to comedy, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's so much. And
Do you know what's really? It's really funny. I didn't act. But I did go to drama club when I was in primary school.
Yeah, man.
And that was my acting career. And I struggled with improv as well because of the anxiety like, oh my God, what am I supposed to? And you're saying something, I'm acting it over with someone and they're saying something to me. And I'm like, where's this? I can do this line really well.
Yeah.
But if you're telling me to make something up, I'm now thinking about all of the things that are possible.
Yeah.
They're looking at me, you're expecting something.
Yeah.
I'm having to respond to you and then what can I say? And then maybe that's why I'm a writer.
Well, yeah.
Because I'm like, these are the lines.
Which is mental, because I guess like from doing drama as a kid and then doing drama in uni and then becoming a director, whenever I was asked to improv, because I was just like a class clown, I was like, yeah, fine, whatever. But I think it's the same thing that you're saying, like, make people laugh. I'm like, okay, cool. Yeah, joke. I'll figure out a joke.
Yeah, you are. Like,
I'll do a joke right
now.
I
see sometimes when we're having conversations, I can see him going, where's the joke?
And then he's like. It's terrible, but it's like, it's how my brain's wired.
Too much
of a people pleaser. Love me.
I think I was like asked to do something in a marketing thing where it's like, just make her laugh. And I just was like, I actually can't do that. I actually cannot do that. I'm the most unfunny person that I know, and that we're just
going to
be, it's
going to
be crickets.
That is so funny. I'll just make a laugh. I can't do that.
Yeah, I felt so bad as well, because it felt like I was rejecting her.
Yeah. But it was just like, I can't do that.
But I think, to go out, were you asking, if I don't have the time, then I do focus on the text, and I go break it down as you would, objectives.
Yeah.
And beats and motivation and everything. Like, I try and fill it out as much as I can.
Cool, man. I was gonna ask, do you feel like there's a difference between like the characters that you have been casted as and the characters you want to play?
I do think there's a difference, and I think it's interesting having worked in voice stuff as well. My casting those are very different.
Wow.
What I get cast for as an actor, like for theatre and screen, it's in a completely different world for what I get cast for voice. I'm not sure why that is. I think a big element of it is that it is just sound. It is just voice. You're a lot more free in terms of what you can be interpreted as.
Yeah.
I tend to get brought in for a lot of kids' work, kids' voices, which I kind of really enjoy because they're very free, young children. Before you kind of take on a lot of insecurities or a lot of like discipline moments that go wrong and change, you know, your core beliefs or change how you view yourself. There's a lot of freedom in that, and I think it's kind of good practice for me to go and do a character like that every once in a while, because it is just a very different way of seeing life. But at the same time, I play adults as well, but so many different genres, whether it's sci-fi, fantasy, historical, educational, and they're usually characters with a lot of agency, a lot of front-footedness, and you know, whether it's like Manana or whether it's like Jarben, they are, I don't know quite, I can't put my finger on what it is about those characters exactly. And with TV and theatre, I am often cast young as well, because I know you can't see, I'm 5'1". I'm 5'1".
I'm a small babe.
I'm 5'3 with these reasons. Yeah.
You're the same size as Kim Kardashian.
Oh, for God's sake. Don't say that.
Whenever man is like, oh, 5'1", because I never knew that Kim Kardashian was 5'1". So whenever anyone's like to me, I've said this like 4 times this week, because I'm like at work and stuff, people will be like, oh, how old are you? She's 5'1", bro.
Like she's 5'1".
No, is she
five
one, five one? She's 5'1". I think 5'1 or 5'2", something like that.
Bro. Is it? Yeah, man. Wow. Yeah. You can be cakes.
She's I don't know.
Melda Staunton's like 4'12".
No, really?
I don't know. Actually, no, I don't know why I did that to Melda. Sorry. Sorry, Melda, if you're listening.
Melda Staunton's 5'4", guys. Come on, man.
She's 5'4".
But she's reasonable. So I think from far away in an auditorium, yeah, you might perceive that I'm a teenager.
Right, okay. So, that is a child.
Yeah.
so I think I get... It's an interesting, because it's either young or it's... I don't know how best to describe this genre other than like cop adjacent.
Okay.
Fed adjacent.
Okay.
So like, for example, the same working year, I played like a 14, 15 year old in ballet shoes.
Yeah.
Right.
And then I was a 32 year old mom.
Oh, is
but
it?
In the same casting year. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And this happens quite regularly. I play like, you know, 16 year old and then someone a lot older than back to the 60s. So it's very... It's very interesting, but I think the biggest thing that stands out to me about my TV and theatre casting is the class aspect to it.
Oh. Okay.
Which is that I don't often get sent working class characters.
Oh.
Which is interesting to me because I am working class.
Yeah.
And I have friends who, like, we've grown up, have very similar upbringing.
Mm. Yeah.
Like, I was born in Manchester. I grew up in Hume and Gorton. For people in Manny, you know that. Those
Lancashire slander. It's northwest.
And then I moved to South London. I spent the majority of my like formative childhood in South London. I lived in Patmore Estate. Shout out Patmore. And then I moved to Crawley.
Yeah.
Shout out Crawley.
Shout out.
Kind of.
What about then the CRW?
Broadfield.
Interesting
is that in all the places that I live, you know what I mean? Gorton, Hume, Patmore, yeah. Broadfield. For the people who know those places.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We know what it is.
You know what it is. And I'm often playing upper class or middle class, and I think they're often what we deem like colorblind.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Which is a very interesting subject. I would love to know what you guys think of colorblind. But how I often interpret is that the character is written white.
Of course.
And they are just kind of open to who auditions for it. And I just feel like in voice, I've been given much more like East African work specifically. My mum's Kenyan.
Yeah.
My dad's Yemen. Sorry, that's not funny about Yemen. I think that's something as I was saying Yemen. Big up Yemen.
Big up Yemen. Big up Kenya. Big up Sierra Leone. Big up Congo.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Is that 5 minutes? I've already scored.
Yeah, okay.
That's good. I'm Kenyan and Yemeni. I grew up with my mum, so I'm much like more in touch with my Kenyan side.
Yeah.
But I'll even get casting for that stuff.
Yeah,
it's not that I haven't ever, but I think it's maybe once.
Right.
In TV and film, maybe once, maybe twice.
Yeah.
Mm. They were interesting.
Yeah.
Some of it was my fault. Some of it wasn't my fault. But that was interesting stuff. Whereas I feel like the game side of it is much more. It's just much more colourful. It's a lot more experimental. It's a lot more bold. A lot more. I think it's brave.
Yeah.
There's just much more diversity in roles that I'm being offered for voice work.
Yeah.
And I think maybe the visual is a big part of that.
Yeah.
But I don't know what sets me apart from my friends who've grown up in a very similar way in South London to me, and we have completely different castings. They'll be going up for stuff that's set in London, what they call urban.
Yeah.
Urban work, whatever. I don't find that I got up for that much.
But like,
interesting.
Do you go first? Or
I don't know. Are you going to respond to that?
I was. Yeah.
I would. Maybe it's like a, I don't know. When I look at you, if you were to walk into my office and be like, can you put me in something? I maybe would, you don't strike me as a, I don't know. I don't
Tory.
Know. As a Tory. You don't strike me as a Tory.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
It's not giving Boris. Yeah.
No, but
it's
I
not
think,
giving Kemi.
Do you know what I think? I think you, although you've moved around a lot, you have London sensibilities.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
I can hear slight African dialect in the way that you speak.
Yeah.
But also, so I don't know.
But then also, what I was going to say is that, like, obviously.
But then also, you don't have that typical London sound. Black girl look or sound.
So
I don't see you with the 30-inch bust down with the slicked hair and portrayed as. Do you know what I mean? This is the diversity that we're talking about in regards to work.
Well, yeah, because I was going to say that obviously there is a. We've been talking a lot about there being a specific way to write and produce and distribute black work. Mm-hmm. And so firstly, you have to figure out for ourselves how we define black work. Mm-hmm. How I define black work really and truly is work that has been like written, produced, directed and distributed by black people. Mm-hmm. And is writing characters that are trying to that are from some form of the diaspora and trying to represent that in some way. Mm. So that's how I really understand black work. But I do understand that we have lots of corporations and organizations that have, like, you know, their diverse work, or they've got like the work that they're putting out at the moment where they're going, no, this is the BBC's version of our diverse work or whatever. Mm-hmm, so I think in those projects, I think that there is a particular genre that black Britishness lies in, and the genre that black Britishness is, it's very kind of two-dimensional. And I think, but I think also, like, it's really interesting because me and Amado have been talking about, like, Halfway, and the experiences were Halfway that we had, we were treated like we had been writing for like 50 years. Mm. Like, choice of cast, being able to be like, we think Grace would be amazing for this, or being able to be like, oh, we'd like this person, like being able to be in the room and talk to the director, who was phenomenal. Shout out Holly Redway.
Yes, shout out Holly Redway, actually.
Yeah, big up Holly, love Holly.
The best.
Yeah, man. But like genuinely, like I think we had, do you not think we were given such a great opportunity? We were able to write however we wanted. The majority of our characters were black. Like, everyone like that we wanted to be black was black. We were going, we want them from this country, we want this, we want these accents. And you wouldn't get that in film. And I think sometimes when you're just talking about it lightly and you go, you know, it's white supremacy.
Yeah.
Like I think it can sound really
fluffy.
But I think that there's definitely a way in which like the imagery of black people. Like, I think there's a way that black people are supposed to look on film.
Yeah.
If that makes sense, without sounding like Malcolm X. But I think there's, like, because of the people that are making stuff, I feel like they're like, we kind of want our projects to kind of look like this and this when it comes to black Britishness. And I think that's maybe a limitation.
Yeah.
Well, definitely a limitation.
Yes, I mean, first of all, I just want to apologize. I did burp earlier.
But you'll get
if
bad.
You're just listening to this, I'm really sorry. I didn't mean that, it just escaped from your throat. But it's an interesting one because I've actually never, I mean, I don't have any childhood like kind of like home videos, so I can't completely like confirm this. I have one somewhere, but I don't believe I ever had a very strong South London accent to begin with. So these kind of like indicators that we look for like authenticity.
Yeah.
It's interesting, it's like what you say, it's very confined, it's very limited.
Yeah.
Even though we know like that's not true, we know that there's range to it, we know this. And there's other people that I know who have like really extremely posh accents.
Completely
RP and are grown up in another estate, like
You
know, close by. So it's just very. And there's so many interesting, that's a whole different tangent, there's so many interesting factors into why we speak the way you speak and how we pick up accents. Like, for example, for me, a lot of majority of my time, my free time, I was listening to TV
and yes.
playing films.
Yes.
So who was I hearing the most and who was I kind of speaking out loud to the
yeah.
most? It wasn't yes. often other people.
Yeah.
So your accent, I feel like some people experience this phenomenon with kids, with their kids, where they were letting their kids watch, what was it? Is like Angelina Ballerina or something, and American kids with like British accents.
For kid. Yeah.
Like really interesting. Like anyway.
Like the girl, like the villain in High School Musical 3,
who's like. I've literally just rewatched this. Who?
You know the one that's like supposed to be Sharpay.
Oh.
And she's like, hello, I'm here to tell.
Yeah.
What were you supposed to be, girl?
It's all I wanted. Want it. Jarring. So jarring.
She is annoying.
No, I recently did a High School Musical and / Camp Rock.
Yeah.
Oh my God! Yay!
Music is
myself. No, honestly, I actually forgot Camp Rock 2 existed. I actually had never watched it.
No, yeah, I was getting thrilled by
it. I used to force my brother and sister to sing it with me, all of Camp Rock 2. So it was like, all right, come on, guys, let's go. Wouldn't change a thing. On 1, 2, 3.
But you know, I just feel like the main issue is that. How companies and theatres take on initiatives to diversify, whatever. It's kind of locked up if the overall structure is not changed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because you're kind of trying to bank on people's imagination. I think a big part of casting is your imagination.
Mm.
How can you, if someone's in front of you not presenting, some parts of the industry are very straight down the line. People are cast specifically because they've seen something you've done before and they want that exact same thing. And there are actors that make a lifelong career out of playing that thing that they know they're good for.
For real.
And it doesn't mean that they can't play something else, but that's what they're playing.
Mm.
Yeah.
And in terms of when I'm in front of someone, when I'm doing that little chatty, nice, and maybe I'm kind of mimicking you now a little bit.
Yeah.
And that's the only bit of me that they see. But do they think that's me?
Right. Well, I was gonna say that like maybe it's less to do with how you look and less to do with what we write. It's more to do with what they accept.
Mm.
So it's their stories, which is why at the beginning I was like, the emphasis of Black stories, it's for me, it needs to be, we've had this conversation a lot where me and Imelda have been like, what's a Black British film?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? What's something that has been written, directed, produced, and distributed by a Black British person?
Mm.
And I think it's a really good exercise to do because I think once you get to that point, you kind of go, maybe there's none, or maybe they're like short films.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? That haven't been funded by bigger things. But I do think that like maybe it's got less to do with like you as an individual, what you look like or what you sound like.
Mm.
It's more to do like, can they fit you in this box?
Because
I was also gonna say like, I'm really interested in the stories, maybe because I lived this experience, but like, the people that like, that lived in London at some point, but then lived somewhere else.
Mm.
Or the people that have come from certain different areas of the country.
The regional thing.
But not just like, I'm from Scotland, but the kids that have like moved around.
Moved.
And maybe that's just because I had that. Mm. Like I was born in Southgate, lived in Enfield, and then moved to Preston.
Yeah,
and like, that was a completely different experience.
World,
and my understanding of my Blackness was warped, it was changed, it was stilted. And then when I moved back to London, and now I'm in West London, and me and my mother meet in St. Charles College, shout out St. Charles, that was a completely different experience in West London, where we're going from like being one of like, four Black people in a school, to then being one of like,
hundreds.
Yeah, I mean, like it was a mental thing.
And
I think that that's there is an evident, like there's evident like idiosyncrasies and dynamics within that, and I write those in characters.
Yeah.
So then I'm going, let's take something from Hume, and let's take something from Crawley, and then let's take something from this, and then also you add the elements of then like my parents are from Congo, or my parents are from Sierra Leone, or my mum's from Kenya. You know what I mean? And like those things are what I think makes characters like
three dimensional,
but you don't necessarily get those stories. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you don't even get them simply from like right now we get a lot of Nigerian stories told through a lens of how we want that Nigerian story to kind of be set. Like, yeah. I think there's been an acceptance of like the Jamaican story and the Nigerian story.
Right. Yes, yeah.
But I think when you then go to other places, like, oh, I'm from Mozambique, people are like,
who?
Do they have jollof rice? do you know what I mean? Because I don't know if we're going to be able to do it.
Episodes are out every Monday and Thursday, so please put the notification bells on for new episodes. We have special guests on Thursdays, and we have lovely chats on Mondays.
Yeah.
Please, Mondays and Thursdays. Mondays and Thursdays. Thank you so much.
I think that leads us quite nicely onto my next question, which is like, have you faced any limitations in the casting process?
This is an interesting one. I wanted to say I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think I'm gratefully offered a kind of variety of different characters, but I think, I mean, this is very different, very like a kind of tangent. There's sometimes on a technical level, I'm dyslexic, so sometimes I find like, sometimes you get offered more than one piece.
And they
can suddenly flip on you something like that you've never put your eyes over. I find I've had one audition that was like hilariously bad because of that. But that was just a little tangent out there. But
that's actually really good to know, because I know that I've done that in the past where I've been like, hey, and maybe this one as well. So it's good to know that.
It's like, funny, you know what I mean? Like, we're profusely apologising to you afterwards. They were like, sorry, that was really not good of us to do. And you know it's gone bad when they're apologising. But no, I think the limitations I experienced are kind of my fault. I can't lie. I was really kind of talking to my agents about the kind of work that I wanted to do. I was talking to them about this kind of colorblind casting box that I'm finding myself in. And one of, sorry, another tangent, I'm really bad at saying one thought process. But I find colorblind casting difficult to understand because I don't, there's no one alive that doesn't come from somewhere.
Talk about it, bro.
That, as in like, you'd have to be maybe born in like, the International Space Station, but then you're still from the
International Space Station.
So when you, the idea that you can write a character that anyone from any background could play and it wouldn't change anything at all about them, I just find really strange. And you kind of end up in these you end up in these really strange situations. Like for example, I was playing a character who, the character's not black, was changed to black. And in the time frame that we're in, we're like, this is actually insane to be here and living this life and going to school.
Right.
And because it was the 1930s. And I was like, and my character's getting in a lot of trouble at school. And they're like, maybe your character's just really naughty. My character could be naughty. And that's, you know, a lot of bad behavior. But never once was it even thought of, do you think she's being bullied? Because she's literally the only black person that anyone has ever seen. Yeah. And you can go and find, you know, like British Pathé, whatever, those old videos, old street interviews of people being asked, how do you feel about black kids going to your school? And how do you feel about black people moving to Britain? And you know what the general opinion was. And also, just to say that then another black character appears in the story, and my character just never clocks it. And this is not to go, the writer or the director or anything like that. It's actually just an interesting thing is that thought never enters their mind until the actor brings it up. I think, you know, it could be the small things like, you know, she flips her hair up into a ponytail or she puts her shoes on the bed. I love white people.
Shout out white people.
And I feel like often we're kind of seeing a lot of historical dramas where we're kind of going, well, the fun thing is we switched it.
Well, yes.
Yeah. Everyone's black or everyone's this. And I know that there is a space for that. I understand. And I actually don't have a problem with it, whatever. What I'm actually kind of looking for is to play people in worlds that I'm adjacent to. Stories that, you know, that it makes real sense for them to be there, and not in a I don't want anyone mixing me up with any groups of people who are like, yeah, stay in your lane.
Yeah.
You're very happy about what I'm saying. But
I was, it's so interesting you saying that.
I think
that,
when people attack DEI or diversity initiatives, it feels because like you're being shoehorned in. And the problem is, if you aren't diverse in that casting level and in the writing and the production level, they are just trying to shoehorn you in because they have no idea how to write a story around you. Or they would commission people who could write those stories. Do you know what I mean? And I'm also kind of don't want to be in the 13th century in some...
Well, do you know what's really interesting about your saying? We've had this thing... I don't even know if I want to say it. Maybe I do. We've talked about this a lot. And I've got a really small gripe with a very big movie. Mm. And so Wicked... Right? Oh. Love Wicked. Oh, I love Wicked.
Do you know what's so funny? Is that I lecture part-time.
Yeah.
And we had this huge back and forth about this, what he's about to say.
Okay.
And it was so intense that I wrote it into a lecture for MA students. Because I was like, this needs to be discussed.
Now massive.
Like, this is a huge conversation.
Yeah. But now, massive disclaimer before people try and clip it or like and try and turn it into something that it isn't. Mm. We're talking about the complexity of colorblind casting.
Yeah.
I love Wicked.
Spoilers ahead, I think.
Yeah. If you haven't seen it.
If you haven't seen it, brother,
like the new movie's coming out, bro. Like, come on, like get quick. and also it's on. It's in the West End right now and has been on there for like 20 years.
Yeah. But just like in case no just one's case, seen spoiler, it. Or, yeah, or yeah, knows yeah. The story.
Spoiler for the people that live under a rock. oh no, great.
No, I literally.
I love Wicked. I played Fiero in secondary school. Oh. Fucking love it. I love musicals. I love it. When Cynthia Erivo was casted as Elphaba, I was like, bro, like powerhouse. I love Cynthia Erivo. Yeah, great singer. Awesome. Watched the movie, loved the movie. Movie was phenomenal. The issue that I had was that we had this massive conversation about Elphaba being black.
Mm.
Hold on. Before you go there, there was a lot of sort of contextual conversations outside of Cynthia Erivo's casting.
Yeah.
Because there were people saying that, you know, Elphaba is black.
Yeah.
And her green skin is simply a metaphor for the black skin.
Yeah.
Or for the black person or black female.
Well, experience.
Black female experience. There was conversations that Cynthia Erivo was having about, having micro braids and things like that.
So and informing that to the character.
There is an element of a blackness that Elphaba sort of has.
Which could be phenomenal.
Yeah.
Could be great. Elphaba could be a black person within the story of Wicked.
Mm-hmm.
The color blinding thing, they always make these mistakes. They make these really small mistakes. If Elphaba is a black woman,
dark skinned black woman that looks
like Cynthia Erivo, and the only reason why her skin is green is because her mum drank a
her dad drank an elixir
that then when he had sex with her mum that then ended up making a green baby that still looks like and has the biology of her mother, who is a dark skinned black woman.
Yeah, so in the movie
Elphaba's mom
is a dark skinned black woman.
But Elphaba's dad is played by Jeff Goldblum.
So how would Jeff Goldblum and this dark skinned black woman create
Cynthia Erivo?
Now this is a problem. this is actually a problem. I don't know.
Because what's her name? Nessa Rose, her sister, is a light-skinned mixed woman.
Sister is Cynthia Erivo. And this is the same thing. Like, I see this all the time. Netflix does this a lot, where it's like, oh, we had this black boy and he has two black parents. And then you go back to the, you know, every like episode 8 is always the flashback episode.
Yeah.
And when they're a baby, they're light skinned. And it's like, guys, like,
how have we done that?
And I think, I don't think that people are doing it on purpose. I think they're doing it because of, I think there is an ignorance there.
I think they actually don't know what people look like.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because I think this colorblindness is a really safe way of going, we're including people. Yeah. And I think, cool, all right, we're including people. But if we're then saying, like, we are in Wicked, we're including people's cultures and we're including where we come from, like, then, like, cast Jamie Foxx.
Yeah, I think it was Jeff Goldblum casting. Unfortunately, Elphaba's dad needed to have been dark skin for us to get on board with the fact that Cynthia Erivo was Cynthia Erivo's character. And having the micro braids and having the, and being, you know, black and green are sort of metaphors and then this sort of liminal understanding of each other. And I think that it was either,
which solely for Elphaba could maybe make sense as Elphaba solely in the character.
Yeah.
You then put her in the world, it then becomes a little bit more,
particularly if Jeff Goldblum is her dad.
But then you feel like that guy that's going, actually, if a man was, you know what I mean? You feel like that person.
His
dad wouldn't be Jeff Goldblum. His dad would be Denzel Washington or something like that. Do you get what I'm saying?
But I feel like this is a problem dating back to Fresh Prince and Mike.
Sometimes
a little niece turns up and you're like,
the swapping out.
When
Nikki was born, it was like, now wait a minute.
Hold on.
But I mean, to be fair, I feel like, you know, from that side of things, I'm sure people, you know, like, I think the African American gene pool is a lot more diverse.
Of course.
there's a workaround and there's like understanding there. But I don't think our casting directors are doing it for those reasons. Maybe, you know, anyone can look the Eve gene.
Yes.
And everyone could. Sometimes it's just a bit. I think the interesting is it's consistent. Often consistently find casting kind of doesn't line up and make sense. I mean, sometimes it's not that much better for white people either. You're like,
these people,
you know, and you're working with a limited pool and all these kinds of things.
Mm.
But,
or even just culture, I think, sometimes where it's like, if it's an Italian and an Italian's going, this is not bit, or even Emilia Perez is a very good example of that, where they were saying everyone that was in Emilia Perez
was Mexican.
But I think it was like one actor was Mexican and everyone else was a French director and there was a lot of
Puerto Rico, someone else was from Venezuela.
Yeah, and they're going, we're talking directly about the social economic issues within Mexico, but then we've got a vast amount of people that don't necessarily understand.
Maybe the closest person
I think is Selena Gomez. Was that right?
No.
Oh, okay.
Selena Gomez is like second generation.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Anyway. But yeah, I think again.
But also,
I
don't think she's second generation Mexican. I think she's second generation something else.
What? Yeah. I don't know. But I think again, it's this idea that, like, you know, A-listers and casting comes before like logic and story.
Yes,
I think that that's also a problem.
Yeah.
And I think that I think that sometimes cultures and societies that people really don't appreciate, like black Britishness or like certain African cultures or other cultures, they just get the bottom of the barrel shit.
Because
you have enough money for R&R, but then you don't do it to understand like what someone else's dad should look like. Or, I think that stuff is weird.
Mm. Sorry, I realised I went on a massive tangent and actually never answered your question,
Have you faced any limitations?
Yes, and I'm so sorry.
No, it's fine.
This is great.
So the limitations. So yeah, I had that big conversation about colorblind casting with my agent, and there I kind of wanted to be able to audition for stuff that's close to my own culture. But I'm a big dummy because, like a lot of people born here, I don't speak my mother tongue.
Mm.
Right. But then.
And it's not specifically for getting, you know, just work here. I think there's a really interesting world that I would like to explore more and be kind of involve myself more in, which is kind of this like diasporic network. Like, for example, there's a film that's really, really good. It is on Netflix. I believe it's called Soul Boy. I think it was Ginger Ink Productions. It's a film filmed in Nairobi.
Okay.
Oh, cool.
And it's an hour long. It's a really tight story. I just think it's really, really good. And when you see that kind of storytelling and like what's possible, like there's another film that I really like, which is City of God.
Yeah.
And those kind of like worlds, you know what I mean? That you just, you can't make that work here. And so I was like, well, I want to go there.
Yeah.
Like make that work. Obviously Yemen's a different story. We're under siege and famine, yeah. Not famine, starvation. There's so many things going on in that country. And I really just, you know, I don't know even really what to say, but it would be great if, yeah. You know, I could go there one day, see my family there one day. But I can go to Kenya, and all my family is there in Kenya, and there's so many stories that I want to tell. And there came an opportunity where I was offered something.
Yeah.
Based in Nairobi, and it was Kenyan. And I looked at the material, and I felt like if it's not a Kenyan writing it, you're going to fall for some traps,
yeah.
Which right. I felt like it did. And I didn't feel comfortable with that material.
Mm.
And in other situations, I remember I did an audition for, I think, what ended up being The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind.
Yeah, oh, okay.
I did the worst audition of my life.
Oh, no.
It's a self-tape, so I'm glad I didn't embarrass myself in person. But often, sometimes I am offered that work and I don't take it. Because one, it really heavily depends on who this story is meant to be telling the story of. And I think we've had this conversation before.
We have, yeah.
Because if you're people of mixed heritage, there's often a lot of, I think, important critique and examination and analysis of who gets what roles and why, which, you know, like, for example, if I was, you know, both my parents were Kenyan, and I was watching someone who's meant to be a Luo, my tribe is Luo, I'm going to be like,
Yeah.
If I squint, like, I'm going to say, well, that girl looks maybe more Swahili, or maybe she looks maybe more Ethiopian, or something. Because we know our culture, we know ourselves.
Yeah.
So if I was meant to be playing a Luo, even as much as I want to take that role myself, and I want to represent my people, and I love my people, and I love my culture, and I really do love being Luo, but it's not gonna make sense, you know what I'm saying? If the character is someone who's just in Nairobi, someone who's just in Siaya, or Kisumu, or someone who's there, and that isn't a pivotal part of their story, I would feel comfortable to do that piece. But if it is something where you know both of the characters' parents are meant to be Luo.
Yeah.
I can't see the I'm now looking at that more than I'm looking at the story or the you know what I mean? And I think this is hard because I think people of mixed heritage will answer this question differently for themselves. You know what I mean? Like, I know people who are like, well, this is my culture and I'm gonna play it and there's nothing you can say about it and I am who I am and it's none of your business. And I also support those people as well. It's just really how I feel I could best do my job. I wouldn't be able to stop thinking about it. You know what I'm saying? And so I think one of the things that I could do to take that was one of those limitations of myself is learning Swahili, is learning the Luo, is learning Arabic, though I have tried that, guys. That is...
I think it's really admirable hearing that. I think me and Imelda have a lot of those conversations about, like, particularly when you feel like you're a little bit of an outlier in your own culture, and you have people that are so like you know, like I can kind of speak Creole, but my Creole is bent. Do you know what I mean? So I try not to speak Creole. You know what I mean? A mother doesn't like to speak Lingala.
I was gonna say that
you know, I think that we need to give ourselves a little bit of grace in that space.
A little bit of grace, because I think
that, like, you know, there's been projects of that I've written or conceptualized, or like, I'd love to do this in Sierra Leone, but maybe I'm not the best person to do it.
I
think there's something beautiful in being able to be like, even though I'm from this culture, you know, we don't have to have like a colonizer mindset where it's like, just because I'm from here, I must do it. Like, there might be someone,
there might be someone that could do it better. Exactly that. I think I just wanted to just caveat, like, if it made it sound like people in Kenya don't speak English.
Yeah, predominantly speak English, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. But you will see it in the script. The challenge will come up if your character is switching from English to Sheng, which is, you know, kind of like Swahili slang spoken like in Kenya, which is mixed with a lot of English and stuff. If you can't pick up on those nuances of the yeah. text, yeah. You know I mean, obviously you can go study that stuff. I'm not saying I could be, you know, I could go and study and do this really well. And, you know, I just wanted to put that out there that, you know, yeah. I'm not implying that.
Yeah. But, it depends on the script.
Yes,
but I think that's a really important thing, because then that is creating maybe a space in film where people can write an array of different stories.
Yeah.
And we don't feel as Black people, or however we identify, that we have to represent everything and anything at one time. Because we live in a space where so many people, we can, hopefully there can be this utopia where so many people are writing stuff. Mm. And then wouldn't it be great if there was like 10 different Kenyan films being made this year,
yeah.
and there's one that you could be like, I'm going to be in the English, and you know what, and then the story that resonates, it's like, I'm going to be an English speaking one, yeah. while this other one that's in the mother tongue is going, while this other one that's a sci-fi is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I think, you know, like what you said as well, is you're not kind of, I'm trying to veer off any kind of sense of going somewhere and feeling like you're the one who's going to start something. I think there's a really big trap, like you say, a very kind of something that we have to kind of examine in ourselves when we grow up inside of empire, really, that there are things that we're being programmed into believing as well. And I really have to keep an eye on that in myself.
Mm.
And there are so many, there are production companies, there are artists doing beautiful work already in Kenya, and I just really want to be able to audition there as well as here, like how, you know, some friends, they audition in America and they audition in Britain, or and also just there's so many multiple reasons why I want to do work in Kenya, to be like closer there and to family and to take in, you know, a different environment. But the biggest thing is I feel like there's a kind of stagnation that maybe we're avoiding talking about in the industry that's happening over here, and a lot of it's economic.
Yeah,
we are going through a recession,
right? Yeah.
Hugely massive, and we're not talking about it that much because everything was kind of saying, you know, it's going to bounce back after the pandemic, everything's going to bounce back, but things have basically permanently changed at this point. And I think that stagnation has led to a lot of fearfulness. It's a combination of private equity and the recession, where we're kind of trying to go back to IPs that you already know. We're seeing a lot of remakes or sequels, or we're reinterpreting this book for the ninth time. Or, you know, we're kind of reproducing the show that we already had. You know, we're trying to, you know, stay very adjacent. And I'm seeing it kind of spill into theatre a bit as well, which is kind of strange, because it's kind of meant to be the last bastion for fresh, new, provocative writing. Not provocative in a rude way, kind of like trying to get under people's skin, but there's been a complete abyss in the theatre scene, where, you know, I remember when I was in drama school still, there were plays on about Ukraine, there were plays on about the Oslo Accords, there were plays on about different wars, different events, different politicians, monarchs. There were plays that were, you know, on the edge, and that's what theatre's always been, as in from Greek times till now. It's a sphere for ideas and political debate. And anyone who kind of wants to say, you know, depoliticize art is not, you know, art isn't political. You're talking about something quite historically different. If you're talking about the actual arts historically, where we can trace it, at least in Europe, that is absolutely its goal. Yeah. Like the Greek play was about rhetoric.
Yes.
And it was in a space where actually only, you know, sort of important Brecht. Citizens could listen to it. Brecht, when you go into Brecht, and when you look at any European kind of theory that informs most of modern British theatre, that is under a political situation. The stuff that I learned about in Bosnia, there's a theatre company called, I think it's MTM 1974, it might just go by MTM, but it's Mostar Theatre, and there's a Mostar Youth Theatre, and they performed throughout the war. There was a bombed out cinema, and people would sneak into this theatre during ceasefires to, you know, put on a play about what was exactly happening outside of their walls.
Yeah.
There are theatre companies still working in the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, the Palestinian
right now. Exactly, who are trying to make sense of what's going on, happening to them, their destruction. It's such a different mindset. And our theatre used to be like that too, but there's been very minimal stuff because we know that our money doesn't come from a place where it's completely
clean, or even
condition free.
Yes.
And there's a lot of countries that operate still on a state funded theatre basis where your funding comes in regardless of what you put on or don't put on.
Yeah.
And I think that the kind of in the 60s and 70s, this was very evident, and 80s was very evident in our scene. You know, like if you think about that play, I brought this up to a friend before, but there's a play, and I'm really sorry I've forgotten the name, but there's a scene where this baby gets stoned to death in a pram. It's a very like, it's probably not reducing the play to, you know, just that. And I've heard it is quite classist in a way, but that's by the by. But there were people walking out of the theatre going, this is disgusting. But that theatre didn't get lose its funding. That theatre didn't get cancelled. People still go back to the play. Some people who weren't going to go did go. And that's the nature of theatre. And I feel like, you know, limitations that I'm finding in the casting, I don't think so much is about what I individually get offered. I think I'm lucky in that regard that I have a variety of, you know, roles offered to me. Yes, they are a bit like cop adjacent, like nurse, wife of a cop, or is a cop, or is a school student, but kind of functions like a cop. But I think really the limitation is what a limitation of what we're all experiencing, which is that there isn't that boldness in stories that I personally see more in games and anime.
Right.
Like the kind of stories that you get in anime, like really, truly, truly. Like, I know this is silly, I'm just going to throw some out there, but like, you know, like Bongo Stray Dogs is such a different thing. Sakamoto Days is so different.
Yeah.
Apothecary Diaries is so different. And Freirin's so different.
Yeah.
Mm. Like, obviously, there's the big shonens as well, or, you know, whether it's Chainsaw or Jujutsu Kaisen or whatever. But, you know, like Cowboy Bebop. Yeah. There's so many. And I think that's why the film does draw continuously from games and from animation and vice versa. They feed each other.
It's just more stringent. But then that brings us brings us really nicely onto our last question, which is obviously because we've been talking a lot about trying a lot. I think firstly, very eloquently said, and I mean, I agree like massively, because I think that we are seeing an economic crisis. We're seeing a complete different change in politics. We're seeing actual strip of freedom of our freedoms and our rights and our freedom to speak or our freedom to protest. We're seeing a change in the world that we're living in. And I think that on a small scale, on a big scale, Imelda and I are making a direct decision to operate outside of those structures. And we're trying to do that by going, we see a lot of issues with how the structure of television is being made at the moment. And we're trying to do something different by making projects in a way that doesn't necessarily have to hold to all of those limitations. And we would love to know, in your opinion, because we are making a TV show without a studio, how do you make a TV show without a studio, Grace?
You tell me. You know, I really just, I don't really at all know how to go about these things. I'm a bit a lowly actor. But I know that I have an appetite for it. You know, like I'm you know, there's a lot of fantastic creators, storytellers, artists all over the streaming platforms that I love watching them. I love going consuming their work. The problem is that the YouTube experience is almost kind of, you know, impossible at this point.
Yeah.
In terms of like the watching experience, you're getting so many different ad breaks.
Yeah.
And like now if you pause the screen, you get like an extra ad while you're...
Yeah.
It's kind of taking away from the watching experience. So I find it hard for like long format artists and stuff like that. There are like, you know, artist owned platforms, like Nebula is the only one that comes to mind, but I know there's way more than that. I'm ready to be on those new platforms. I'm ready to like go and support them directly, whether it's Patreon, all these kind of things. The main problem is that I get there and they're not there. Like, you know, my favorite creators that I go and watch, they're not on those other platforms. And so I have to kind of stick to YouTube or TikTok or whatever it is to
engage with them.
Yeah. And there is like, I know there was someone in, I can't remember which country in Africa, but he was also looking at opening a streaming platform that's kind of similar to Netflix, but is kind of more local productions. And you have like, I don't know if it's Showcase in South Africa, Showcase Max, something Max, Show Max. But you can't get any of that here. Yeah. Like, you can't actually stream, you can't get onto that app or stream from here. Yeah. So it's, I really am feeling the drought.
You know what I mean?
And I feel like it's really filled by the gaming world. I love games. I love the games that I've been able to be a part of. Mm. I can't play my own games because I'm so bad. Like, I literally couldn't find my own character in Elden Ring because I just kept dying in Caelan. Anyway. I had to wait for other players to get there so I could see myself.
Just watch the stream.
Yeah, literally watching the streams. Like, anyone?
Yeah, yeah.
But I think what's interesting about the indie game scene and how it's kind of blowing up is they have something like Steam.
Yeah,
where indie developers can put their game up for sale on this platform. And some games do really well, like Stardew Valley or other like kind of like small teams or small base. I mean, even like Expedition 33 blew up, and it's a much smaller team. They are, you know, professional studio. But I think that's the missing piece of the puzzle, because we can go onto streaming platforms, but it's that gamers are able to directly earn money from those sales
on
Steam. Yeah. They don't have to go through another party. And I don't know how TV and film can overcome
monetize
this part. If we had something that worked like Steam, where you can go buy rent off, you know, off the thing, that is not having to go through the big three, and not the anime big three, but you know, it has to go through Amazon or Netflix, or and it can be pulled at any time. Like, you're in the middle of watching something, and I just will never forgive. Like, I was it 1895 or 1899? It was like the follow up to Dark on Netflix.
Oh yeah.
I was like, where's my show?
I feel like that about teenage bounty hunters.
Oh my god!
But then, go on.
Yeah, no, go.
I was just gonna say, like, if you were to give any advice to anyone that wanted to start, if, like, say in a sentence, they were like, "I'm trying to do this," what would you give them?
I'm kind of on this journey myself, to be honest. Yeah. Maybe I can't give advice to other people because I have not done anything that I should advise you. But at the moment, I'm trying to hone like my skills for, you know, illustration, or whether it's music or illustration or storytelling and writing. I don't consider myself, a writer. And then everyone goes, everyone says that. Yeah, I'm writing. That's how you be a writer. So, okay. I don't write. But I am trying to get into that world. And I feel like it really is, working it into my daily routine has been like getting my physio into my daily routine. Like, I have these certain injuries that I've been going to physio for a long time for, and it wasn't until I kind of looked at it from so many different disciplines that I was actually able to get more out of my physio, and now I feel like I'm actually on my way to progress, not just recovery, but like progress, like in strength and flexibility and other things. And I feel like my craft has been the same way. I kind of was in a very educational setting for so long. Like, I went from primary school to secondary school to sixth form to drama school, and then I was in the industry, and I was very used to this kind of studious approach. Always taking so many notes, being very studious, trying to learn as much as I can, and not enough time cultivating myself and my interests, my genuine interests that I would do if I was, you know, left alone to do whatever. And so that's what I've been doing. I've been reading and watching material specific to like what I want to explore. So like, for me, that's historical stuff in Kenya, like historical aspects to like my own tribe, but also other tribes. I'm very interested in indigenous people. So I've been kind of, when I say indigenous people, that's such a, you know, very big term. And big bracket. What I'm trying to say is that I'm very interested in people that are somewhere between an agrarian and a nomadic lifestyle. This group of people, which is the majority of people, actually, by the way, like majority of people in the world, as in live rural lives.
Right,
not agrarian, nomadic. But as in, most of the people live much more in contact with
the natural world.
That kind of world. And I'm very interested in it because I'm only one generation removed from that.
Mm. Yeah.
So my mum and the way my mum grew up has nothing in common with the way that I grew up. And I'm very interested in what city life has done to me mentally, physically, health-wise. Not necessarily a bad way. It's not necessarily a bad thing. I'm just very interested in, had I been born in Kenya, in the village where my mom was born, would I be any different from who I am now? Well, I'm very interested in that, that difference of lifestyle and the difference in approach. We are hurtling further and further towards a city dominant planet. Most people will be living in cities by 2050. Like Kenya right now, it's like a 70-30 split. 30% of people live in the city, 70% of people live rurally. And that's literally going to flip on its head. Yeah. You know, they're predicting. What does that mean for our cities? What does that mean for our countrysides? Who now owns our countrysides?
Yeah.
Monsanto.
You
know, but it's you know, and it's a centuries long way of life that's being broken. But even before that, you know, sorry, I'm going it very, you know, nerdy into the details of what, but I'm looking at something very specific. And I think it's good to start with something very, very specific. And then I watch something that's kind of the opposite of that, and I see how these two worlds marry, because I'm so interested in that. Like, I'm so interested in the way that sci-fi collides with reality, or fantasy collides with reality. I love stories based around like that, like whether it's Studio Ghibli or, you know, anime in general. There's much more fluid understanding for, and your work, your work reflects that specifically as well. Like, do you know what I mean? I think you explore that stuff as well. And we talk about that a lot. Like, very nerdy, but we like that kind of stuff. So,
but I think that's really dope. It's like, you know, trying to look outside of what's in the city or what you get every day and try and look outside of yourself, because there's a lot of stuff out here that we can be eating that we don't, that isn't just the stuff that we're given. I mean, that's sick, Grace.
Amazing.
I did okay.
You did really great, man.
Thank you guys so much for tuning
in.
We'll be back next week with more videos.
Yes.
So follow along. Please donate to our Kickstarter.
Yes.
And we will see you guys really, really soon.
Really, really soon.
Amazing.
Oh my
gosh.
Oh god.
I need to pick.
Go, go, go.
Oh, that was amazing. Thank you,
Grace.
So much.
Whoa.
That was stunning.
We would have. We've run over.